Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ Basic Functions and Commands for New Users. Today's presenter is Valerie Lemkin. Valerie has supported WebSphere MQ for 11 years. She is certified as MQ Administrator for both version 5.3 and version 6, and is also certified as MQ Application Development and Solutions Expert. She previously worked for IBM Global Services Division, servicing customer accounts, and currently provides WebSphere MQ Level 2 support as member of Software Group. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Valerie.
Thank you, Joseph. Okay, today the presentation is going to be WebSphere MQ Basic Functions and Commands for New Users. This is going to be a basic fundamental coverage. We're not going to get too in-depth, but it's targeted for people who are maybe new to supporting MQ and haven't had a lot of chance to take training, and so we could give an overview. And I'd like to cover quite a bit of information today, so we're going to be moving rather quickly. Can you go to the next slide, Joseph, which will show the agenda? We're going to start out talking about the MQ files and commands and MQ objects. We're going to go over logging and how the dead letter queue works, also cover security authorization, how the listener works, and how to implement triggering. We're going to give an overview of clustering and finish up with some troubleshooting tips. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, the quick beginnings guide that I've listed here is something in the Info Center online. That the Info Center has many different manuals for MQ that you can reference. And the quick beginnings is basically for different platforms to tell you how to get started installing and configuring your systems. One tool that is also valuable when you're setting up a new system or to check that your setup is adequate is the MQ config script. This is just a script that will check the semaphore, shared memory, and other settings that you have implemented on your system and make sure they meet the minimum recommendations for WebSphere MQ, and it can be downloaded from the web link that I have listed there. In most cases, AIX is self-tuning, but other platforms do require that the system administrators set some kernel tuning parameters. There are special considerations for Solaris 10, which implements projects, and that is explained at the bottom of that MQ config website when you go to look at that. Okay, next slide, please. Slide 4, the installation directory for MQ product code is OptMQM for most platforms or UserMQM for AIX. The working data is stored in the VarMQM directory, and you cannot change these locations. You should not. It's recommended that you create separate file systems for the log data in the VarMQM log and error files, VarMQM errors, to keep the data if one should fill. Then you don't necessarily have a problem with corrupting or overwriting in the other file system if they're separated. The VarMQM log file system is where active logs are stored. MQ error logs and FTC files are written to the VarMQM errors directory. So sometimes when we ask for logs and we're saying key manager logs, those are actually in the errors or in the VarMQM key managers, and it would be specific key manager name, errors directory, not the logs that are in the logs file system. Those are the active logs where the key manager is actually writing and storing data that it uses internally, not the reporting logs that you would go to view as a system administrator for troubleshooting. Okay, let's go to slide 5. Additionally, MQ file systems, the OptMQM or UserMQM for AIX file system contains the binary MQ executables in the bin directory. Sample MQ programs can also be located in the SAMP directory under the OptMQM or UserMQM. Some of the most popular sample programs that are used are AMQSPUT, to do a PUT message, AMQSBCG, to browse, and then AMQSGET. When you use the GET, you're actually doing a destructive GET, whereas the browse, you're getting the message for you to view, but it does not take it off the queue. There are also samples that you can find for dead letter queue, triggering, et cetera. If you go to the application programming guide, which is found in the Info Center I mentioned before, it has more information about the individual sample programs. Okay, let's go to slide 6. I'd like to discuss the configuration files. The MQS Any file, there's one file that's the MQS Any file on the system, which is affects MQ on the whole node. And this location is in the bar MQM directory. It contains the defaults and lists all the queue managers defined on the node. Now, there may be multiple QM.any files because there will be one for each queue manager, and it's located in the bar MQM queue managers under the specific queue manager name directory. And it affects the changes for the specific queue manager. Any changes you make to a configuration file usually do not take effect until the next time the queue manager started. The values defined in the QM.any file would take precedence over the values in the MQS Any file because the MQS Any file is for the server as a whole, and you can make specific, more granular changes in the QM.any file so that your queue managers could differentiate between each other. Okay, let's go to slide 7. Control commands. These are commands that can be used by a system administrator for configuration of MQ. Commands are case sensitive and they're lowercase. Some of the most common are the create MQM, start MQM, end MQM. Normally on the end MQM, you would use the dash I option. I usually find that is how I use it 99% of the time. If you just issue an end MQM without the dash I, which I means immediate, then it will run until there are no further requests from an application or any process to have the queue manager do work. So it could take a long time for it to end that way. Usually the immediate means let's stop processing what we're doing and end it. There are other options like a dash P for panic, and that really is not recommended because you could have some issues if you use that. So the dash I is probably the most often used for ending a queue manager. The delete MQM, which can delete a queue manager, you probably want to be sure you have a backup if you're going to be deleting any queue managers. And the run MQSC starts the MQ scripting language. When you enter that, you will then be able to type in run MQSC commands. And to see all the available control commands, I've provided the link there to the system administration guide in the info center. Let's go to page 8, please, slide 8. Okay, a default queue manager can be created by when you use the create MQM command with the dash Q flag. And a default queue manager would be specified in the MQS.any file. You can also go and change your existing queue manager to make it a default queue manager by adding the following stanza to the MQS.any file. For example, here, test queue manager. When you change a default queue manager, it can affect users or applications. Any application that connects after you've changed it will then connect to the new default queue manager if it's not explicitly implying a queue manager name. That basically is what you are doing when you give a default queue manager. You say that we can connect without specifying the queue manager name. This is the queue manager that I want to connect to automatically. Or when you type, for example, when you type run MQSC, you're basically connecting to a queue manager. So you would not have to specify the queue manager name. You would automatically go to the default queue manager. That can be a little tricky if you have multiple queue managers and you really were trying to make some changes or connect to a different queue manager. So that might be something to consider when you're doing your setup. Let's go to page 9, please. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about the run MQSC commands. The MQSC commands enable you to perform administration tasks, for example, defining, altering, or deleting a local queue object. And they're also very useful to delete, start, stop, and you can view all the run MQSC commands in the script command reference manual. One thing I like to use this is because the same commands that you issue in run MQSC on Unix can be used on Windows in a command prompt window. So it can be used on, a lot of people use Explorer to administer Windows and also to remotely administer Unix key managers, but if you're using the scripting commands or even if you write out a script command that you're going to read into run MQSC, you can use the same commands in a Windows command prompt that you would use on a distributed Unix platform. Okay, let's go to slide 10. And I'm just going to go over a couple of the queue types, the local queues. There's a normal, and there's also a transmit queue. alias queue is basically just a pointer to a target queue. Alias queue really cannot hold any messages. Almost like a funnel or a pointer, it's just going to route that message directly to the target queue. So when you do a put, the target queue is where you're doing the put, although you specify the alias queue. Remote queue points to a queue on a remote queue manager. And when you do that, you're actually putting to the local transmit queue because it's going to need to be picked up from the transmit queue by the channel to transfer across to the remote queue manager and the queue where you're actually would be your target queue from the remote queue. For cluster queues, there are many different types of queues which can be broadcast as part of the cluster. You can have alias queues, local queues, etc. We're going to talk about clustering more later in the presentation. There are also model queues, which basically are a template for a dynamic queue, which an application can either have permanent or temporary dynamic queues that they create on the fly, and then they can, if they're temporary, they can close them when they close out their connection at that time. Okay, let's go to slide 11. Here I've provided a link to a name resolution table that may help clarify how the messages are routed. Sometimes there's some confusion if you're doing puts, especially in clustering or something, exactly where the message is going to be routed to, how the resolution occurs within MQ, and what transmit queue it would go across. So this table and the info center may be helpful. It shows how the messages are put to the local transmit queues. For example, you might get an error that queue not found if the queue manager name you're giving is blank and there's no matching local object and the cluster queue can't be found. So in some cases, you could have a name resolution error if you don't have your specifications for the queue manager and the queue name as it would be expected in this name resolution. Let's go to slide 12, please. We're going to talk a little bit about channels. There are different types of channels: sender, server, receiver, requester, client connection, server connection, cluster sender, and cluster receiver, or what each of those are. On the next slide, we're going to look at a common example of how a sender-receiver channel pair would be defined between two queue managers. Go to slide 13. For a channel example, when a message is put on the queue manager 1 to a queue remote definition where the target queue exists on queue manager 2, it is actually put to the transmit queue named queue manager 2 in this particular example. If you have channel triggering properly enabled, this will allow the sender channel, the queue manager 1.queuemanager2, to start, and the message channel agent will start the receiver channel, queue manager 1.queuemanager2, on queue manager 2. Once the channels are running, the message will be read off the transmit queue and sent across the channel to the target queue on queue manager 2. This is somewhat of a standard naming convention for sender and receiver channels, is that you would use the queue manager name where it's originating and the queue manager name where the destination is as the naming for channels. That often helps with administration to tell what the channel is sending to on the remote side just by the channel naming. Okay, slide 14, please. Logging. We're going to discuss a little bit about, there's circular and there's also linear logging, and during the create MQM is when you have to specify the type of logging that you're going to use at that time. And you can do that with a -LC or -LL on your create MQM command. The total number of primary and secondary log files cannot exceed 511 on Unix systems or 255 on Windows. The log file size may not be altered after a queue manager is created. The number may be increased, but not the individual size of the log. That would take a queue manager rebuild, and it can be rather complicated, especially when clustering is involved, to rebuild the queue manager and add it back into a cluster because the queue manager ID would be changed when you recreate it. So it's good to go before you start creating the queue managers and logs to do some planning in advance to decide how many logs you think you're going to need and the size. The log control file is the amqhlct.lff file, and that's found in the log subdirectory. Here I've given the default location of the logs for the Unix and the Windows platform. Let's go to the next page, slide 15. There's a DeveloperWorks article that I've used quite often. It was written by Tim Dunn, and I've given it here because it has a lot of information and guidelines for configuring and tuning Web3MQ for performance on Windows and Unix. So it covers logging, log buffer size, and is a great resource to learn about the intricacies of logging and during your planning stages of how you may want to set up your log file size and the number of logs that you're going to use. Okay, next slide, please, slide 16. And here I've just given you the Unix log defaults. If you don't specify number of logs or sizing when you do the create, this is what you would get just by a normal create MQM taking the defaults. Circular logging is the default. And you would only have 3 primary and 2 secondary files. Okay. So as I said before, you can go up to 511. So there's quite a bit of difference in the default and in what can be specified. The other thing to consider in the primary logs and secondary log file sizing is how much space you actually have available on the server, because you don't, obviously you can't create more logs than you have file space. So you need to take that into account as well. Okay, next slide, 17 please. A common log error message that we get see quite often is AMQ7469 for transaction rollback to release log space. Sometimes it's recommended to increase the number of logs, but that might not always be the correct answer. Really, you should investigate to see why the transactions are not being committed in a timely manner. Perhaps you have a long-running unit of work, and that is what is causing the log space not to be released and causing you to need to have more log space than really if you were doing a shorter commit time, then your log space might be adequate. Okay, next slide, 18, please. Okay, now we're going to discuss the deadline queue. When messages cannot be delivered to their intended destination, they're sent to the deadline queue by the queue manager. MQ provides an automated way of handling these deadline messages with the deadline queue handler. It's invoked by the run MQ DLQ command, and that's the default routine supplied by Web3MQ. We recommend all queue managers have a deadline queue configured. It can be added via the runmqsc alter queue manager command after you've already created it, or it can be done at the time of creation with the -u option. For example, here we've given create MQM with the -u system deadline queue for a test queue manager. If you do not specify a deadline queue, it could cause your queue manager to hang or go into a loop if a message is undeliverable and there's no deadline queue defined for it to put to. It has no way to proceed past that point of processing that message. So we definitely recommend that you have a deadline queue defined. And that doesn't automatically happen. As I said here, you have to go in and either alter your queue manager or specify it when you do the create. Okay, slide 19, please. Now here's an example of how you would alter when you alter the queue manager to configure the deadline queue. Here we've just put the system deadline queue, which the system deadline queue is automatically exists. If you want to create a specific application-specific deadline queue, you would need to create that. But the system deadline queue is a local queue that is created. You just need to associate it with the queue manager by specifying it in the dead queue attribute. Okay, slide 20, please. Often for troubleshooting, when a message is put to the deadline queue, we will need to determine the reason that it goes to the deadline queue. And the AMQSBCG browse program, which I mentioned earlier, is a great tool for browsing the deadline queue and looking at the header and the message data to determine why the message went to the deadline queue. So let's go to 21, slide 21, which has the second portion of that deadline queue browse. The first part was just showing us the deadline queue header. But as you look into here, what I've highlighted here in red is actually the reason code. And this comes out in hex, 805 hex equals a 2053 return code, which means the queue is full. So, and one thing to note here is on Windows, you may need to flip those bytes due to the little Indian, big Indian differences to determine the hex of what the code is. But for example, if you had a queue full, then once your application, maybe your application had stopped for some reason, and once you get the application back up and running, you may want to reprocess these messages if they didn't need to be processed in a certain order. And you can just send them again. You can use, let's go to slide 22. We're going to discuss the RunMQ DLQ, how you can use that to process messages off the dead letter queue. For example, if you were going to need to read in a rules text file in the dead letter queue, in this example, you put the name of your dead letter queue, then you put the queue manager name, and you read into a rules text file that you create with rules table. And the rules table can contain information such as wait, retry, forward. So you may want to retry messages if the queue was full. And you can also put other commands in there to filter, for example, by reason code, such as queue full, then to retry. Or you can further match things, and you could forward them to a different application queue if you matched on a specific application name. Okay, slide 23, please. Now we're going to move to talking to security and authorization. Authorization for using MQI calls, commands, and access to objects is provided by the Object Authority Manager, often shortened to OAM. The setMQ AUT command is used to grant or revoke authorizations as needed. A security refresh is required after a setMQ AUT command is issued. This can be done by recycling the queue manager to refresh the security cache, or by within RunMQ SC issuing a refresh security command. There are also some commands you can use, the DSPMQ AUT and DMPMQ AUT, to view what authorities are already set on specific objects. One thing to note is that when you, on Unix, if you are adding a user ID to a group that may already have the necessary authorities, that ID doesn't automatically get added to the security cache when you add it to the group ID. You would have to refresh that security cache so that it goes and picks up the new user ID that you've added to that group. Because once the security cache is read in, the queue manager keeps it and doesn't go out and check every time for new users that might have been added to a group. Let's move to slide 24, please. Okay, WebSphereMQ Listener, it's a TCP/IP server program. Normally, it listens for connections. The default port is 1414, but it can be configured to listen on other specific ports. With the new versions of MQ, it can be invoked via command line or defined as an object. We no longer recommend using the INETD to run Listener. Instead, the RunMQ LSR allows us to pool channel processes and has less overhead. So here's an example of how you would start the listener. You would specify that's TCP IP listener and give the queue manager name and the dash P for the port you want to run on. You can also define a listener object here below as in the newer versions of MQ where you have it as a control of the queue manager. This allows the listener to automatically start and stop when a queue manager starts and stops, if you have the control set to queue manager, as I've shown there. Let's go to slide 25. Keep Alive is something I want to mention because MQ will enable Keep Alive if you request it by inserting this TCP stanza in a QM.ini file. And when Keep Alive is enabled for a connection, the system starts a timer for connections and resets the timer whenever packets arrive. The system tests the connection when the timer expires and aborts the connection if there is no response. This is particularly useful when you have client connections and perhaps the client has gone away, but your queue manager was not closed correctly, the queue manager doesn't realize it's gone away. If you have this Keep Alive enabled, then it will be constantly checking to see if packets are arriving from that client connection, and it will abort the connection if the client is no longer sending any updates over the TCP. The Keep Alive interval is set at the OS level by the system administrator. And basically, when you put the Keep Alive stanza in your QM.ini file, you're just opting in to say, yes, I want to use that parameter that the system administrator has already set at the OS level. So you need to work with them to determine what limits they have set. Let's go to the next slide, please. triggering. A message is put to a queue defined as triggered. It may be first, depth, or every. Those are the different types of triggering options you can use. If a series of conditions are met, the queue manager sends a trigger message to initiation queue, and this is called a trigger event. A trigger monitor reads the trigger message and takes the appropriate action based on the content of the message. Typically, that's to start a program to process the trigger queue. Next slide, please. These are the different trig types. First is when the trigger event occurs when the depth goes from 0 to 1. This type of triggering should be used when the serving program will process all the messages on the queue, i.e., they're going to read until there is no message available returned. And please note that only the trigger first only occurs when it goes from 0 to 1. So if you already have a couple of messages sitting on the queue and you add another one, it's not going to trigger this event. It only happens when it goes from 0 to 1. If for some reason your triggering has failed and you already have messages there that started, you're going to have to manually start it up to read those off to get those cleared out. Every is a trigger. The next type is every. A trigger event occurs every time a message arrives on a triggered queue. This type of triggering should be used when the serving program will only process one message at a time. For example, on ZOS, I think CICS might be something that would trigger on every, and they would have multiple instances running. Depth, a triggered event occurs when the number of messages on the trigger queue reaches the value of the trig depth attribute. This type of triggering would normally be used when the serving program is designed to process a fixed number of messages, for example, all replies for a certain request. When triggering by depth, triggering is disabled and must be re-enabled by MQ set or alter queue local, and that's normally done within the application. So most often what we see used would be trigger type first because you want to start the application up when you get the first message on the queue. That is the most common use of triggering. Next slide, slide 28, please. For triggering setup, you would need to create an initiation queue, or you could use the default queue, the system default initiation queue. You would also need to create a process definition. The application ID attribute of the process definition normally would contain the script that you're going to trigger. You would also need to create or alter the local or model queue, and then you would need to associate the initiation queue and the process definition with the local queue and specify the trigger attributes. You could do that by altering the queue to add the process, the init queue, and the trig type, and then set it to trigger. Next slide, slide 29, discusses trigger troubleshooting. When you are having issues with triggering, you should verify that the application name is correct and exists, verify the application is coded correctly, and the correct authorizations are in place. You also want to make sure that a trigger monitor is active. You may want to start the run MQTRM as a no-hub so that it runs in the background and your trigger monitor doesn't end if someone logs off or closes a session. Trigger monitoring also is often set up as part of a startup script, and it can also be defined as an MQ service object, similar to the way the listener was, where you set when you define the trigger as an object, then you could set it to start as with the argument with the queue manager name and a init queue, and you start command run MQTRM. If you set that with the control, the queue manager, the way the listener was, then the trigger monitor would start up and come down with your queue manager every time. So that's an option you can do in the more recent versions of MQ. You also should verify that your trigger type matches your application design because, for example, if you have a trig type for first, but the application is only reading and processing one, and it's not reading in a loop, then while it's processing that one, more messages could have arrived on the queue and not created the trigger events that you would have expected when you are doing a trigger type. Basically, when the trigger message is read and it starts processing, your queue is set to no trigger until it finishes and goes back for the next time and sets it back once you've finished. A another way to troubleshoot is to manually try starting the triggered application at a command line or to make sure it actually is able to run. Sometimes your triggering is starting and trying to start the application, but within the application, it's unable to complete. This could often be due as well to authorities. I've seen sometimes when someone triggers the application, it starts, but that application is actually trying to call another script, and that script that it's calling is where the failure is. So once you get triggering working, you need to make sure that the entire application process that triggering can complete. Let's go to the next slide, slide 30, and we're going to talk a little bit about clustering. This is just a diagram that many of you may have seen before, but it just shows the cluster key managers, shows the manual, and the auto-defined channels. In this particular drawing, Key Manager 1 and Key Manager 2 are your full repositories. So they have channels communicating to each other. Key Manager 3 joined the cluster and also created a connection to the full repository on Key Manager 2. When it did that, Key Manager 1 was notified and created, as you see by the dashed line, those auto-defined channels to include Key Manager 3. So when you are, let's get to the next slide, slide 31. The System Cluster Transmit Queue is a transmit queue through which all messages, data message and administrative messages for the cluster, are sent between the queue managers. Each queue manager has its own System Cluster Transmit Queue, which is created as a default during the Create MQM. There's a workload algorithm that determines how messages are routed. Often people are expecting a round robin, but it may not always occur in the designation as you're expecting because there are 12 different steps within the algorithm that affects how the cluster routes messages as to which has been the least used, if it's currently available, and you can go to the link I provided there to read through the algorithm for all the steps that are included. Slide 32, please. I have some clustering tips here. The AMQRRMFA is the repository manager process. This governs all the cluster activities for a queue manager. It must be running for the repository cache updates to occur. So if your AMQRRMFA repository manager process has died, then you're going to have cluster issues because it's not going to be able to keep it up to date. The only way to restart the AMQRRMFA is to recycle the queue manager. You can't just restart it at a command line. That will not work. Every cluster has at least one, preferably two queue managers that hold the full repositories. These have the information about the queue manager's queues and channels in the cluster. The reason we prefer two is because internally, when the update messages are created that it sends out between the cluster, there are two created. So if you have two full repositories, it just helps it stay better in sync, and then you have a backup should one of your repository managers be down. Queue managers need a cluster receiver and a cluster sender channel definition in order to join a cluster. A cluster sender channel that is manually defined needs to point to one of the full repositories. Once you have established that connection by creating your cluster receiver definition, which gives the connection name of the queue manager where you are, and the cluster sender channel, which gives the connection to the full repository, then with just those two definitions, you're added into the cluster because the full repository queue manager that you connect to will then send update information to all the other pertinent queue managers in the cluster to let it know of your queue manager that has just joined. And then if they need to send data to you, they will create an automatically defined channel, and you don't have to create channels to those other queue managers within the cluster. One important thing to know is that you can only get from a local cluster queue. You can put to any queue in a cluster, and it will be routed across the cluster through the transmit queue and the channels. But when you're doing a get, you can only get locally. You can't get from a remote cluster queue. Let's go to slide 33, please. Cluster troubleshooting. For investigation of clustering issues, please collect what we call the cluster must gather documentation. This includes any FDCs from BarMQM errors directory, the queue manager logs, which are found in the BarMQM queue managers specific command your name errors directory, and a dump of the cluster using the AMQRFDM and RunMQSC outputs. And this link is for the MustGather. It has some attached little text files that you read into the AMQRFDM and the RunMQSC to create output text files that will give us a dump of the cluster cache and also of display of the cluster objects through RunMQSC. AMQRFDM is a utility that can be used also at command line by customers, and I don't really have that explained here on the slide, but basically when you type AMQRFDM, it brings up a menu. One of the things I would use it for often is once you bring up the menu, the lowercase t actually allows you to browse the system cluster transmit queue and will give an output of how many messages you have backed up on your system cluster transmit queue and where they're routed to. If they, for example, if you see that you have 100 messages routed across one particular channel, then you need to investigate why that channel, why they're not going across the channel. Is the remote side down? Why can it not put those messages, and why are they backing up on your system cluster transmit queue? So the AMQRFDM, when we request it for the MustGather, we are feeding in an input file that's going to put out a lot of information for us. But you as a user can also use it. It's just a menu-driven function that lets you look at different attributes of your cluster. Okay, let's go to slide 34, and that is just cluster references where I have given the link to the info center that has the QManager cluster online manual for you to look at further if you have additional questions about clustering. Slide 35, please. I mentioned before about the MustGather for clustering, but here I've included the link for the MustGather documents for all different distributed problems that you may encounter. It also has troubleshooting guides on many of these different ones. For example, you could, once you go to this link, you can select Windows Data Conversion, and it will, you go to the Windows tab and you select the link for data conversion, it will tell you what you need to gather to submit to us for PMR purposes, but it will also guide you through some troubleshooting steps that you can do on your own before you even open the PMR if you're able to resolve the issue yourself. So the MustGather documents, if you're not familiar with that, it is something that can be very valuable in troubleshooting and also to speed up your problem resolution, because when you do open a PMR, if you have the documents we're going to request already to attach and send in at the time it's open, it can really speed up the resolution process. Slide 36, please. This may be something a lot of you are familiar with, but for troubleshooting, some of the main things we look at when we first start troubleshooting are the FDCs, and those are failure report files that are written to the var MQM errors directory. MQ names the files on the distributed platforms and Windows with the AMQ, and then the XXX.Y is the process and number, and that's why when you see them each name, some of them may be really large. That means that process is writing out a lot of errors. And the key manager logs are something that we usually need to look at as well. Those are located in the var MQM key managers under the specific key manager name errors directory. And the most current messages are always written to the first error log. One thing to note about these is that they are circular and they do overwrite themselves. So if you're having an error and your logs might be filling up quickly, but you may want to take a backup of the log, just copy over a backup so that you have it and rename it to something else, because it's going to keep writing to these logs and overwriting them. And if we request you to, or you want to look at the logs later in the next day or even later, it may have already overwritten the information that you needed, because it's really the most valuable thing is to have the QManager log where you can match up the timestamp for the timestamp in your FDC files and correlate what was happening with the QManager at the time the FDC file was written out for a failure. The next slide, 37, shows a sample FDC file, and this tried to bold it here, but it's not really clear, but the probe ID is what is normally the best thing for searching if you're going to try to do some problem resolution on your own. To search the IBM website, you can copy the probe ID. You may also want to look up the component. And as you look down further, you'll see the probe description, AMQ9207. Most often you would see that error in one of the AMQ logs that we have, whether the queue manager log or the system log that corresponds to that, is written out at the same time the FTC is created. But the probe ID is, in many cases, unique and will help us troubleshoot what problem you encountered that caused this FTC to be written out. Okay, next slide is 38. And FFST summary, this is a command that can be used when you have a lot of FTCs and you want to find out what was going on. You can type FFST summary at the, you need to be in the directory where the FTCs occur, and then it will put out an output like this. You can also reroute that into an output file so that you can later view that file. But it basically gives you a summary of the FTC name, the date, and now the timestamp, I believe it may be written out in GMT time, so it may not correlate to your exact time. It may be 5 hours off or something to that effect, and the timestamp here, you'll need to verify that by looking at the actual FTC to find your local time. But then it will give the probe ID here, as we saw before, the CO05-2000. Normally, when you look at FTCs, often the one that is most important or has the most significant information is the first one that was written out when the error occurred, because the subsequent files that are written and the errors you see after that may just be fallout from what the initial problem was. So that's why it's good to look back at, and if you get the summary, it also sorts them in order, timestamp order, as you'll see here, where you can look and see what occurred first. Okay, let's go to slide 39, please. And this is discussing return codes and error messages. One thing you can do at a command prompt on a server where you have MQ installed is use the MQRC command to check error codes and return codes. For example, if I typed in MQRC 2053, it would show that means queue full. So if you have a code coming out that you don't know, like 2035, it would be authority error or something like that, you can just go to your command line and type that in, and it's kind of a quick lookup for you of how that works. You can also type in not just a reason code, but an error code you might see in the log, for example, the AMQ9207, and see what that code is equivalent to. Then I've also provided the link to the online manual that shows you all the codes that you would see for MQ so that you could look them up in the manual as well. Next slide, 40, is tracing. The next step in troubleshooting, if we're not able to tell from the FTCs or the logs what your problem is, then we often would request that you provide a trace, normally a high-detail trace. The output files go into your VARMQM trace directory, so you need to make sure you have plenty of space in there and that the directory is empty before you start tracing. And I've given here the syntax for how to start a high-detail level trace, then you would recreate the problem, and then you would end the tracing. On Unix, you need to format the files. We're using the dstmqtrc command, and then that will create a .fmt file that's formatted for each trace process, and you can send that to us for review. If the error is occurring before the queue manager startup, then you can't really specify a queue manager name because it's not running. Instead, you could do the -e option, which is not queue manager specific and would capture all the MQ processes that are occurring. And also here's the link for the MQ tracing direction. Another way to trace is also a wrapping trace. So if you're not able to recreate the failure on demand, then you may need to implement a wrapping trace that where the files are wrapping and they're not continuously growing to fill your file system until the error occurs again, and then it could be stopped. Next slide, please. This chart includes some links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. To visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts like the one you attended today. And you can access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. Visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. Now I will turn the presentation back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Valerie, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Rachel, we would like to open the line for questions.
Our question comes from Ramu Kura. Your line is open.
Yeah, my question is regarding the MQI channels. I mean, it is both server connection channel and the client connection channel together called as MQI channel. Is it correct?
I'm not sure I understand your question. The
okay.
Client, the
yeah.
Client connection channel and the ServerCon channels?
Yeah. Are they together called as MQI channels, message queue interface channels, or because when we create a client channel table, we specifically define a client connection channel, which is matching with the server connection channel, and we provide a client channel table to the client. So if we don't have the, if the client doesn't want to use the client connection channel, they can connect to the queue manager using the server connection channel. So in that case, what will happen to the client channel?
You mean the client? The client channel? They're using the server channel definition that exists on the queue manager.
Yeah.
A template for, or as a, they can with the default server con or one that's explicitly defined for them. Yeah. So the client connection would use the template that's set up as a server con connection. Yes, it would come in that way. If I'm not understanding your question correctly, maybe I can, you can email it to me. Do you have my email address at the just on the beginning?
Yeah,
okay.
I have it, yeah.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Carl Bly. So your line is open.
Hi. I noticed that we were talking about MQ version 6, but I've downloaded it and been playing around with version 7.
Right.
I'm trying to tie together a ZOS machine with a Windows platform, and I was not clear. Do I have to install MQ on both machines because the requester is going to come from my ZOS machine to go to my Windows platform to gather up data for various DB2 applications, CICS applications, and VSAM applications. So do I need two servers, or do I can do a server and a client?
Well, you can do – with ZOS, it's a little trickier because you have to have a specific add-on for ZOS to use client connections, and I'm not sure from your question if your Windows is coming as a client connection, but if it is, you have to have an additional add-on to the ZOS Queue Manager to enable client connections. That doesn't automatically happen.
Okay.
Yes.
I think I heard about that, correct.
Okay. Is that what you're trying to do? The Windows going to attach, you're trying to attach the ZOS as a client?
Well, I want the ZOS to be the main machine who's requesting data from the Windows SQL database.
Okay, then I think you're probably going to need to set MQ up on the Windows, but this is Carl Bly, right? Yes, I think you're going to need a queue manager there if you're going to be making calls. How are you going to plan to make your calls to the DB2?
Well, the DB2 is on the ZOS box. However, what I'm trying to do is some of that data has been migrated to a SQL box. So what I want to do is I want the application still to function off of the ZOS box, but really pull the data from the SQL database on the Windows platform.
Okay.
So I thought I would need two MQ series servers running on both sides,
right.
Two channels requesting back and forth for my various files and applications.
Right. That would probably be your best set up if you have a server on Windows and ZOS.
Okay. Okay.
And for each file, we have two channels, right?
Well, you're saying a sender and a receiver channel.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Shazan Samir. So your line is open.
I just wanted to find out the best practices for setting up workload management in a cluster where the same instance of the queue exists on all the queue managers. What's the best practice, and do you recommend to use the cluster priority or cluster rank or anything?
Well, you're trying to have it routed equally, or you're trying to
right.
have... Okay. Well, then if you leave it set as the default, as long as you're doing where you're not binding when you do your open, then it should route it in a round-robin fashion for the most part. My point before being that even though something is routed as round-robin, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go 1-1-1-1-1. It's going to depend on other factors as well, as far as if other applications are using the same cluster channels, then that channel may be considered internally by the cluster as being already used, and it may go to the next one. But I don't. If you are just have your, if they're all the same, you would only use the cluster workload priority or rank if you wanted to give more focus to one particular cluster key manager that you want to receive more traffic.
Okay. So what do usually the customers of IBM, I mean, do, I mean, what do you guys usually recommend? How would you?
Well, the main thing is, like I said, to implement the round robin is make sure that you don't have your default to bind on open, because if you do that, then it's going to bind to one and only put to that one. But if you want to just have the have it routed out so that your workload is handled more equitably across all the key managers in the cluster, then you shouldn't have to make any changes to your cluster workload or rank attributes. They would all be set the same level by the default that you created them with.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay.
Yep, thank you.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Andre. I apologize, Andre Concepa, so your line is open.
Yeah, I would like to know what's the best situation to use the Keep Alive.
Usually when you have client connections is where I see it's most valuable, especially if the client, a lot of times the client application may not be coded correctly where it's not disconnecting correctly, and we see people often get max channels errors because the client, someone could have connected a week ago and sent some data but never disconnected, and therefore it's using up that channel resource. And if you have the Keep Alive in place, it will clean up those old, what we consider to be orphaned channels that aren't really sending any data anymore. So that would be the most likely place on your Key Manager where you have a lot of client connections coming in. And if you see that some of them, if you do display for your client connection channels for the last message time and you see that and the last message date and you see that it hasn't sent any messages for several days, then you probably could consider that an orphan channel that Keep Alive would help clean up and add that channel resource back to your pool. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from Ashok. So your line is open.
I would like to know what is the best connection type when we are connecting the WebSphere applications running on the WASP to the MQ. In our case, let's say the WASP and the Queue Manager both are on the same physical machine, and we deployed some EAR files on the WASP and defined some connection factories to the Queue Manager, and the transport, the type, connection type, we can use either client or bind. So which is the best option if both the WASP and Queue Manager are on the same physical machine?
I don't know that there's the best option that I could recommend. I mean, I think if you're able to do the bindings, then you might. It really depends on what you're trying to do, and that probably would be a question more for someone on the WASP team as to what your application is trying to do when it connects. Now, off the top of my head, I would probably say the bindings would be eliminate some of the possibility of client disconnect, but I'm not sure I can answer that question without knowing more details. So if you want to send me an email with the details, I can try to find an answer from you by discussing it with someone on the WASP team. Okay?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions in the queue.
Thank you, Rachel. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.